And at our worship committee meeting, the worship associates like to hear from the ministers a little bit about the service that they're going to do so that they can prepare a reflection. And I was trying to articulate my thoughts, and Roger says, well, what's the point about romance? I said, well, I think romantic love is overrated. So hence the title of our sermon, which is not exactly what I believe. I am not against romance at all. In fact, in reflecting and preparation for this sermon, I realized I've been madly in love 4 times in my life. Weak-kneed, giddy, obsessed, all the gloriousness that romantic love can provide, including with my current spouse of 22 years. We had the most searing romance in the first 6 months of our relationship together that I would never want to give that up. But my point about romantic love is that our cultural expectations of it are really out of whack with how much romantic love takes up in the context of a longer-term relationship. If you base your ideas about love on movies or music or books, essentially it goes like this. You meet somebody, you have sex with them, that's in the current movies, right? Then you get to know them. Then you have some kind of misunderstanding, and then you get back together and live happily ever after, all in the space of 1 week. Are there any movies, songs, books about happy long-term relationships? Part of the reason why romantic love is so intense, of course, is that it's meshed with lust. A powerful force in our lives. In fact, when we talk about chemistry between people, there really is chemistry involved. It's a very good choice of words because we know that there are some significant hormones that are all part of the process of love and relationship. So lust, our sex drive, is a testosterone-driven feeling for both men and women. And it's a powerful feeling because the creative force wants to ensure that we procreate and sustain ourselves. Now, romantic love is driven by the chemical dopamine, and that the purpose of the dopamine is to ensure that we bond deeply with a single person. The euphoria and heightened sensation that's created by high dopamine levels in the brain can also be stimulated by cocaine, methamphetamine, the drug ecstasy, and of course, the drug of love. So these chemicals are very critical in how we interact and how we fall in love. And romance is critical because it kicks off that very important bonding that happens. But again, I think it's rather overrated because if you look at the long arc of a relationship, even if your arc is only a year, the intensely romantic part is a fairly short time. And of course, we hope that this romantic love is going to lead to bonding that will help us stay together and support each other and nurture each other in our lives. Transition from romance to commitment. So how's that going with long-term commitments in our country? Well, let's see. According to the Census Bureau and the Centers for Disease Control, not sure why they keep marriage statistics, 20% of marriages end in 5 years, 32% within 10 years, 40% within 15 years, and 48% of marriages end within 20 years. If you have a bachelor's degree, you're much more likely to stay married after 20 years, 78% of couples with bachelor's degree. The younger you marry, the more likely it is that you're going to get divorced. And religion doesn't seem to factor in because Protestant couples have the same divorce rate as the national average. But here's the statistic that I find the most interesting. 52% of marriages last a lifetime. And I think it's highly likely that some portion of those marriages are happy. Now, this is what the focus of my sermon is today, that portion of marriages that last, and really trying to appreciate why. Our brain chemistry doesn't stop the process after the lust romance phase. And I'm not saying that long-term married couples don't have lust and romance. It's lovely to have that sprinkled throughout your relationship, but it's not of the intensity in your early years together. But couples that stay together, the hormone involved there is oxytocin. This is the same chemical that is in mother-child bonding. It's the chemical that floods our system after an orgasm and allows us to feel deeply connected to the person that we're with. This is the work of the long term of a relationship, and that is attachment. Attachment can also be considered as compassionate love. It's the spirit of what makes a relationship healthy. And building this foundation of attachment means that you can weather the difficulties that all of us that have been in long-term relationships know come, or the days, like Kevin talked about, where you say, I love you through clenched teeth. So how do we develop this attachment? I've heard people say that relationships are work, or it takes a lot of effort to maintain a relationship. I want to translate that into the idea of you have to be attentive. You have to be thoughtful. You have to make the effort to put aside your own ego, or at least balance your own ego with the needs of your spouse. There are two researchers who've done almost 4 decades of research on why couples stay together, John and Julie Gottman. They actually created a little bed and breakfast site where couples would go and spend the weekend, and they'd record like every waking second of their time together and study it. And they will tell you that these long-term successful relationships are built and sustained by the small day-to-day interactions that happen every day throughout the day. They're little requests for connection, little opportunities. So, for example, you and your spouse are out on a hike, and one of you says, oh, honey, look, isn't that the most beautiful yellow wax warble wing woozit? So what happens next is the critical part. How your partner, that's a request for connection, right? Honey, look at that. Honey, I'm interested in that. Honey, I appreciate that. So this is the moment. How the partner meets that request is the make or break for that moment of connection. And Gottman says there's 4 ways that you can do this. The first way is passive destructive. So not particularly engaged, but rather passive in your destructiveness, like, oh yeah, I saw a bird too. Active destructive. Oh, you probably got it wrong. I'm sure that's not the name of it. Passive constructive. Looking at your phone. Yeah, that's great, honey. Terrific. Active constructive. Oh, wow. That's so exciting. I know you'd been looking for that bird. I'm so excited for you that you found it. So which one of those opens your heart? Which one shuts you down? Which one sustains a relationship? Which one kills it? Which, of course, brings me to the man who won't share his food. I think Carolyn does a really good job of noticing that both sides are contributing to this problem. You know, he's been saying no apparently for years, and she's choosing to ignore his signals. But I do agree with Carolyn in that the wife is putting out her request for connection. Hey, honey, can I try a bit of that fish? And I agree with what she ultimately says, that maybe if you trade a bite of each other's food, you'll both have a teeny something new to talk about, a better idea of what to order next time, but that little warm glow you get from choosing to be open rather than insisting on being closed. That little warm glow of attachment that can ensure your mutual happiness and the health of your relationship. These ideas of active, constructive responses. Wow, I'm excited for you. That's so great. Your attention, your respect, your connection. These are the things that sustain relationships in the long term. Carolyn Hacks asked the question, who should be the one to accommodate here? The man who wants to shut down because his mother did something that made him angry, or the wife who wants to connect. Her answer suggests that by moving past his restrictions, his fears, his anger, it provides him with an opportunity to connect more deeply with his spouse, even on the littlest thing of sharing food. Now, what is it about this attachment? Those of us who've studied child development understand that babies, that's all that they want in their first year of life, in their first few years of life. Like, mommy, look at me. Mommy, look at me. Eye contact, appreciation. It's the same thing. It's just the adult version of the same thing. Share with me. Look at me. Appreciate something I appreciate. Connect with me. Respect what I respect. It's about kindness, generosity of spirit. It doesn't mean that you're not going to get your needs met, because in those successful relationships, it happens in a two-way way. This is the idea of active kindness. In the work by the Gottmans, they classify couples as masters and disasters. Masters, long-term success; disasters, divorce within 6 years, and they go back and check. That's how they know. And they found that in these requests for connections, the masters get it right 87% of the time. Kindness, generosity, attention, balancing your own ego. The disasters make that connection 33% of the time. Gentle kindness, everyday compassionate love. You still have romance, you still have lust, but this is the nature of what makes relationships last, those tiny little daily connections. Kindness, generosity, compassionate love. There aren't a lot of songs about that. I was racking my brain about what songs talk about long-lasting love. I remember "You're Still the One" from the 70s. "You're Still the One That'll Scratch My Itch." It's a lovely song about connection. It really is. You're still the one after all these years. But I think the song that epitomizes what we mean by these healthy, sustaining connections is the song "Try a Little Tenderness." And I recommend it on this Valentine's Day. So may it be.